All right, welcome in everyone to another deep dive. Today, we're really getting into the weeds on a case that's super important for anyone, you know, really grappling with constitutional law here in Washington, State v. Harrington.
Oh yeah, a big one.
Huge implications for how we think about the Fourth Amendment and, you know, our state's counterpart, Article 1, Section 7. So if you're a law student or even, I guess, just a legal enthusiast, this is the deep dive for you, really.
Couldn't agree more. Harrington really gets to the heart of, well, a pretty fundamental question, I think. When does a police interaction, one that seems okay on the surface, when does it actually cross that line and become an unlawful seizure in the eyes of Washington law?
Right, right. And then what does that mean? You know, what are the real world consequences for both the police and the people they interact with every day here in our state? I mean, these are weighty issues.
Yeah.
So we've got a good bit of material to dig into. You know, we've got some notes on how to approach a deep dive like this. We've got this really in-depth case brief. It's got this thing called a perplexity analysis, which I got to say, that's a new one for me.
Yeah, it's a fascinating approach.
It is. It is. And then, of course, we got your classic, you know, standard case brief, just laying out all the basic facts, the rulings, all that.
The nuts and bolts.
Yeah, exactly. So our goal here, and it's a big one, is to really distill, you know, the key insights, make sure we understand this progressive intrusion doctrine that comes out of Harrington. And then crucially, we got to see what it means in practice.
Right. How does this play out on the streets?
Exactly. Exactly. So, okay, let's set the stage. We're in Richland, Washington. What exactly happened that night?
So the case unfolds on August 13th, 2005. It's late, around 11:00 p.m. Officer Scott Reiber, he's with the Richland Police Department. He's out on patrol, and he spots Dustin Harrington walking along the sidewalk. Now, Reiber makes a U-turn in his patrol car, a marked car, pulls into a driveway ahead of Harrington, and then he approaches him on foot. Now, here's a detail that's going to matter. No lights, no sirens, nothing like that at this stage. He simply asks Harrington if he's willing to talk, and Harrington, he agrees.
Okay, so at least initially, this seems like, you know, your pretty standard consensual encounter. But then things get a little more, shall we say, complicated when a second officer enters the picture. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is where things start to get interesting, legally speaking. So as Officer Reiber is chatting with Harrington, a Washington State Patrol Trooper, William Bryan's his name, happens to drive by the scene. Now, he also makes a U-turn, parks his marked patrol car. I think they said it was maybe 10 to 30 feet away from where Reiber and Harrington are standing. And then Bryan gets out of his car. But here's the thing. He doesn't say a word. He just stands there.
Okay, wow. So this silent presence, and, you know, we'll get into this more, but it really becomes a key part of the case, right?
Absolutely.
So two officers now standing there. What happens next?
All right. So now Reiber asks Harrington if he'd be okay with a pat down, you know, quick frisk for officer safety. Harrington said, sure, go ahead. Now, during this pat-down, Reiber feels something in Harrington's pocket. It's hard, cylindrical. He asks Harrington, what's that? And Harrington, he admits, it's my meth pipe.
And that's basically game over at that point, right?
Pretty much. The admission leads to an arrest. They search him and find, yep, methamphetamine inside the pipe. Case closed, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, not so fast.
Right, because Harrington's attorneys, they challenge the evidence, they go to court, and they've got this specific argument, right? What's their angle?
They make a bold move. They file a motion to suppress the evidence. The whole shebang, the meth pipe, the drugs, the works. And their argument, their big claim, is that an unconstitutional seizure had already happened before Harrington ever agreed to the pat-down.
Mm-hmm.
Their strategy basically is to prove this unlawful seizure. And if they can do that, well, anything that comes after any evidence found because of that illegal action, it's all got to be thrown out. It's inadmissible.
Smart tactic. So what did the lower courts say about this?
Well, the trial court, they weren't buying it. They denied the motion.
Mm.
Harrington, he's convicted. He appeals, goes up to the Washington State Court of Appeals. And they actually uphold the trial court's decision. It was a 2-1 ruling, so not unanimous, but still, at this point, the courts are siding with the prosecution.
But then along comes the Washington State Supreme Court, and they flip the script.
Right.
And that's why we're talking about this case today. But before we get into their reasoning, I think it's super important to talk about how Washington's Constitution approaches these privacy rights. It's different. It's stronger than the federal Fourth Amendment, isn't it?
Absolutely. Article 1, Section 7 of the Washington State Constitution, it's unique. It often provides more protection, broader protection for individual privacy than the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution.
Give us the key language there.
Okay, here's the core of it. No person shall be disturbed in his private affairs or his home invaded without authority of law. Now, pay attention to that phrase, disturbed in his private affairs. That right there, that's so much wider, so much more expansive than the Fourth Amendment's language about, you know, unreasonable searches and seizures.
So it's not just about, like, physically searching someone or literally putting them in handcuffs, right? It's bigger than that.
Exactly. The Washington Supreme Court, they've been very consistent. They've interpreted Article 1, Section 7 to really bolster individual liberty and privacy. And because of that, they've rejected this federal idea, this free-to-leave test, as the only way to tell if a seizure's happened. Instead, Washington courts look at the whole picture. They ask, would a reasonable person, given everything going on, would they believe their freedom of movement was restricted because of what the officer did or how they asserted their authority?
So Washington's like, nope, we're setting a higher bar here when it comes to protecting your privacy. So how does all of this apply to Harrington standing there with the two officers? This is where the progressive intrusion doctrine, this is where it kicks in, right?
I got it. The Washington Supreme Court, when they reversed that Court of Appeals ruling, they put a lot of emphasis on the totality of the circumstances and this idea of a cumulative effect of how the officers acted. They basically pinpointed three stages, three escalations in that encounter that led them to say, wait a minute, an unlawful seizure happened before Harrington said yes to the pat-down.
Okay, so let's unpack those three stages of progressive intrusion, as they call it. What's the first thing the court zeroed in on?
The first thing they highlight is Trooper Brian, the second officer, just showing up. Even though he didn't say a single word, the court said, look, he arrived in a marked patrol car. He's in uniform. He's standing there. They called it a police-dominated atmosphere. And the really important takeaway here is that in Washington, this kind of nonverbal backup, it carries a lot of weight. It changes the power dynamic in a way that federal law often doesn't recognize to the same extent. The court was basically saying, even a silent show of authority, it can make a reasonable person feel like, I can't just walk away from this.
So that's a really crucial difference, right? This emphasis on nonverbal cues of authority and how they impact things legally in Washington. Okay, what's the second stage in this progression?
So the second thing that happened is that Officer Reiber told Harrington to keep his hands out of his pockets. Now, you might think, okay, that's a pretty minor request. But the court saw this as a step towards physically restraining Harrington. It was a command, even if it sounds polite. It was controlling his actions. And it sent the message, you're not free to just ignore us and walk away. It shows how even seemingly small instructions from an officer, they can chip away at a person's sense of freedom, especially in Washington.
It's like, keep your hands where I can see them.
Yeah, exactly.
And that seemingly routine request, the court saying, no, that actually matters legally.
So what's the final stage in this three-part sequence? The third and final stage? It's when Reiber asks to frisk Harrington. And the court, they didn't mince words here. They flat out said, asking to frisk someone, that's not consistent with just a casual chat. They reasoned that when an officer asks to do a pat-down, they're implying they think you might have a weapon, that you might be dangerous. It automatically takes things up a notch. It's not just a friendly conversation anymore. And crucially, the court found that Reiber, he didn't have any real specific reason to believe Harrington was armed. He didn't have any facts, anything he could articulate to justify that frisk request.
So the point they're making is it's not about looking at each thing the officers did in a vacuum. It's about the combined effect, the buildup of all three of these actions. And all this happened before Harrington ever said, yeah, okay, you can pat me down.
Exactly. And because of this progressive intrusion, this buildup of pressure, the court said a reasonable person in Harrington's shoes, they wouldn't have felt free to walk away or say no to the officers, not by the time that frisk request came around. That's the essence of the progressive intrusion doctrine in Washington. It's about looking at the whole interaction step by step and how it would have impacted someone's sense of freedom, especially under Article 1, Section 7, which, as we said, gives broader protections.
And because the court ultimately said this was an unlawful seizure, that throws a wrench into the whole question of whether Harrington's consent, whether that was even legit.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So now we get into this really interesting legal concept. It's called the exploitation doctrine. You can almost think of it like this. Imagine a tree, and the roots of that tree are poisoned. Now, any fruit that tree grows, even if it looks perfectly fine on the outside, it's still tainted, right? It's kind of the idea here. The doctrine says, even if someone says, yeah, sure, you can search me, that consent, it doesn't count. It's not valid if it came about because of a prior illegal seizure. The illegal seizure basically poisoned the consent that came after it. So because the court decided Harrington was unlawfully seized before he said okay to the pat down, his consent was no good. And any evidence they found Well, that had to be tossed out.
Wow. So this ruling, it's not just some abstract legal theory. It has real-world consequences for how the police do their jobs and how lawyers argue these cases here in Washington State.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. This case is a wake-up call for law enforcement. It really underscores how strong these privacy protections are under Washington's Constitution. It's not just about the Fourth Amendment anymore. It's saying you have to think about the combined impact of your actions during any interaction, any encounter. Just calling for backup. Even if the second officer doesn't say a word, that alone can be enough to turn a consensual encounter into an unlawful seizure in Washington. Officers need to be so careful, especially about when they start giving commands like, keep your hands where I can see them. And they absolutely have to have a good, solid reason, something specific and clear, before they ask to frisk someone. And police training here, it has to focus on this cumulative effect. It has to drill down on the specifics of Article 1, Section 7.
So, huge implications for police training, police procedures. What about from the legal side, for lawyers?
This case is a game changer for defense attorneys. They're going to be looking at every police encounter with a fine-tooth comb. They're going to be scrutinizing any interaction where multiple officers are involved, really paying attention to the specific sequence of events. And their argument is going to be, look, even if these little actions seem minor on their own, when you put them all together, they created a situation where my client felt pressured, coerced. They didn't feel free to leave, and that's a violation of Article 1, Section 7. For prosecutors, it means they have to be extra careful to show that the whole encounter was truly consensual every step of the way. Or if there was any kind of escalation, they have to be able to prove they had a valid reason for it, you know, reasonable suspicion or probable cause at each stage.
So let's recap the key points for our listeners. The big takeaway is Washington, it's got its own unique body of privacy law. And it's often stronger, more protective than the federal Fourth Amendment. And even nonverbal stuff, like having a second officer just standing there, that can contribute to a feeling of being seized, at least under Washington law. Consent to a search, that doesn't erase the fact that a person might have been illegally seized before they gave that consent. And maybe the most important thing, this idea that you have to look at the whole interaction, the entire sequence of events, not just one isolated moment, to decide whether a seizure took place.
You nailed it. The Harrington decision, it really marked a shift. The Washington Supreme Court was basically saying, we're not going to analyze each little thing an officer does in isolation. We're going to look at the whole picture, the combined effect of everything they did. Did it create a situation where a reasonable person would feel like their freedom to go about their business, their private affairs, without being hassled, was violated?
So much more nuanced, much more holistic, really focused on the big picture and how it all comes together. Now, just to kind of put this into context, how does this compare to federal law? We mentioned that free-to-leave standard earlier in cases like Florida v. Bostick.
Right. So in Florida v. Bostick and in a lot of federal cases, the big question is whether a reasonable person would feel free to just walk away and the encounter. But Harrington, it shows that Washington courts are concerned about any kind of interference with someone's private affairs, any sense that the police are imposing on their freedom, even if they could technically walk away if they wanted to. The second officer showing up in Harrington, for example, that probably wouldn't be enough to say someone was seized under the federal free-to-leave standard. But in Washington, it was a big deal. The court said it contributed to that police-dominated atmosphere that made Harrington feel like he couldn't just leave.
So Washington's taking a much broader view. And how does this all relate to, you know, the legal rules around frisking someone for weapons?
That takes us back to Terry v. Ohio. That's the big Supreme Court case that lays out the rules for stop and frisk. In Terry, the court said an officer can do a quick investigatory stop if they have reasonable suspicion that someone's involved in criminal activity. And they can frisk that person for weapons, but only if they have a specific, articulable reason to think that person is armed and dangerous. Now, in Harrington, the Washington Supreme Court made it very clear that Reiber asked to frisk Harrington without any such reason. He didn't have any particular reason to think Harrington had a weapon. And that lack of justification, that was a key factor in the court saying this was an unlawful seizure that happened before the frisk.
So the timing of everything and the reasons behind each step the police take, they're super important under Harrington. Okay, let's throw out a hypothetical here. What if the second officer, Trooper Brian, what if he never showed up? Would the interaction between Reiber and Harrington, just those two, would that have been enough to say a seizure happened by the time Reiber asked to frisk Harrington?
That's a really good question. And it would have been a much closer call, legally speaking. Without that second officer adding to the police-dominated atmosphere, who knows how the court would have ruled? The outcome would have depended a lot on those two actions. Ryber telling Harrington to keep his hands out of his pockets, and then him asking to do the frisk, all without any clear reason to think Harrington was armed, it's possible the court still would have said, yeah, that's a seizure. Especially because, in Washington, just asking to frisk someone, that's a pretty big deal. It signals that things are not consensual anymore. But it's definitely true that having that second officer there, silent or not, it made the court's decision a lot easier.
So the presence of that second officer, it really tipped the scales. All right, so to sum it all up, what's the core principle that comes out of Stacey Harrington? It seems like it boils down to this. Under the Washington Constitution, even if each little thing a police officer does seems okay on its own, if you add them all up, if you look at the combined effect, it can turn a seemingly consensual encounter into an unlawful seizure.
Exactly. And that's the message for everyone listening, especially those of you who are studying or practicing law here in Washington. We've got a strong commitment to protecting people's privacy, especially when they're dealing with the police. And Harrington is a powerful example of that.
Absolutely. It definitely gives everyone a lot to think about. And with that in mind, here's a final thought for our listeners to ponder. Given what we learned from Harrington, how do you think all these body cameras we're seeing now, and all these other ways of recording police interactions, how are those going to affect how this progressive intrusion doctrine is used and interpreted in the future? It's definitely going to be interesting to see how it all plays out. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.
Great discussion. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate your insights.
Always a pleasure.
To everyone listening, keep those brains churning, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.